hppodcraft.com.
Welcome back to our third episode on Ted Klein's The Events at Porth Farm. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and we are joined again by the illustrious Kenneth Hite.
Hey, thanks for letting me join you yet again.
Letting you? Jeez.
Oh my goodness.
It is a pleasure and an honor, sir.
Well, it's an honor to meet an astronaut. It's neat to have me.
Well, let's just agree that it's super neat and leave it there. So, as we've mentioned on the other episodes, but we can't mention it enough, Ken's got a Kickstarter going on. Can you tell us a little about that?
Tour to Lovecraft, The Destinations, which is the sequel to Tour to Lovecraft, The Tales, which you guys have been so nice as to plug and praise.
We love it.
This is about not the stories themselves, but about the settings of the stories. So it's about Arkham and Dunwich and New York and Antarctica and other imaginary places like that. Lovecraft's response to them as it changes and as Lovecraft changes them throughout the stories, because obviously we know that Lovecraft's version of Arkham is different in each story, mm-hmm. but his version of New York City is also different in each story. So his use of setting is, I think, kind of underexamined. And if I do them all in a row, it sort of lets everyone look at Lovecraft settings as a story element. Hmm. It expands on the Lost in Lovecraft series that I did for Weird Tales back in the day. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, as I speak, the Kickstarter has pushed us into also further additions to Tour to Lovecraft, The Tales, mm-hmm. Get to write some essays about the collaborations, about the Mound and Curse of Yig and Out of the Eons and all the other great stuff that we got to do on the show, mm-hmm. but that I didn't mention in Tour to Lovecraft, The Tales, because there was only so much time back then. Now, more time.
Well, I can't wait to get my hands on it. I'm so excited. Check it out. It is called Tour to Lovecraft, The Destinations.
It is a must-have for everybody who listens to the show. Please go and support that Kickstarter. Can we do a quick synopsis of what's been going on so far in the story?
Okay, the narrator, Jeremy, is a New Yorker who's staying on a farm with the Porths, Sar and Deborah. Jeremy found their cat dead, didn't tell them. Cat came back alive.
Sounded like a piece of ticky tape coming off of leather.
Yes, there's a creepiness afoot, and that is where we are. He doesn't know exactly what the heck is going on at this point.
He's out on this farm because he needs to study up for a course he's going to teach in the Gothic tradition and literature. And when we find him here on June 30th, he's been reading some Shirley Jackson and some Aleister Crowley. He says that he got turned off by Shirley Jackson's view of humanity, so he switched over to Crowley, and I found that odd.
Well, Crowley's super happy with himself, at least, and I guess that sort of spills over. I mean, I have to admit that I rag on Crowley for a lot of things, but his sort of humor is not one of them. I love his sense of humor and his sort of, he's an epic troll in an era before epic trolls. And I just think that's right. Great. He would have fit on Twitter so well. Shirley Jackson, being a grown-up, can't be a giant baby like Crowley is. Mm. And so she has a cynical, not to say Calvinist, view of humanity. Mm. And that's what Jeremy objects to. But again, what's he doing? He's turning his face away from true evil. He's trying to seek refuge in this sort of farcical pretend evil of Crowley's magic. Mm. He goes on to say, inspired by Crowley, I go back to the magical pool in the woods, and I'm trying to sort of get into the nature pan spirit of Crowley, but I see a dead thing floating in the center of the pool, and he doesn't even know what it is, and he just sort of goes away. It had somehow opened up.
That was such a suggestive sentence. What the heck?
What does he mean by that? Yeah, does he mean the pool's opened up, or the corpse had opened up, or like?
I think the corpse had somehow bloomed open.
I don't know if that's maybe another beast that the Shrugug had gone in before, or if the Bwata has been out slaughtering animals and leaving their bodies floating in the pool.
I still think that it is plausible that this thing is more than one thing, that there are multiple things going around out here.
Right. And that we have sort of the main one that has been following him, but that the forest is also being contaminated by this presence from outside. Yeah, I think that that's certainly possible. And it would also explain what the noise was that he heard in the woods. That if it wasn't Bwata, it might have been a fox or another kind of an animal that had been taken over.
Jeremy finds Sar chopping wood with an axe to make tomato steaks. Sar says that he hasn't seen Bwata all last night and today.
He helps Sar chop up some steaks, and it says, my arm hurt after 3 lousy steaks, and Sar had already chopped 15 or 16. Must start exercising. That's every journal entry I've ever written. Always ends with, tomorrow's the day. And I just felt it was very realistic.
Yes, unfortunately. It's July 2nd, and Jeremy is writing at 2 a.m. He says they had a rough day. Seems that Sar woke him up that morning to help him with a burial. Late last night, when they were in bed, The Porths heard the door open, which they thought was Jeremy.
They were prepared to lie in bed awkwardly as he pooped. This is something they've been used to by this point.
Then they heard the cats freaking out, so they ran downstairs and saw Boada was killing Butch, and then ran off when confronted. The kitten, Minnie, was already dead. The Porths had a funeral for the cats, behaving as if their children died, he says. Deborah asked Sar if they would go to heaven, to which he said, of course, but Boada would burn in hell. Sar and Jeremy went out to hunt the cat down and kill it, but they couldn't find it.
As anyone knows who's tried to find a cat in one room, much less a 90-acre farm.
When they returned for dinner, Jeremy stopped by his cabin to change clothes, found the door was open, everything was in place, but his bed was tore up with claw marks. There's feathers all over his sheets, his blankets, his pillow. Everything was shredded.
So is this an intimidation move from the cat?
Yeah. Yeah. This is the horse head. Boada couldn't find a horse, so he did the next best thing.
Sar asks if Jeremy wanted to sleep in the house on the couch. And he goes, oh, no, I got another sheet. He goes, no, for your protection. And Jeremy was like, come on, it's a cat. I can handle a cat. But still, he takes Sar's axe just to have something to get it if it does come after him.
I don't think I want to go to sleep tonight, which is one reason I'm continuing to write this. Intend on sitting up all night on my new bedsheets, my back against the Poroth's pillow, leaning against the wall behind me, the axe beside me on the bed, this journal on my lap. The thing is, I'm rather tired from all the walking I did today. Not used to that much exercise. I am pathetically aware of every sound. At least once every 5 minutes, some snapping of a branch or rustling of leaves makes me jump. Thou art my hope in the day of evil. At least that's what the man said. July 3rd. Woke up this morning with the journal and the axe cradled in my arms. What awakened me was the trouble I had breathing. Nose all clogged, gasping for breath. Down the center of one of my screens facing the woods was a huge slash.
Yikes.
He's got allergies to cats.
Yeah.
And the screen is slashed, meaning that something could have got inside. So there's an implication that the cat came in and just sort of hung around him and then left.
And then we have a little bit of a gap here and we come back in on July 15th.
And it's the narrator's 30th birthday. He went into town to use the phone because, remember, the Porths don't have a phone. And he talked to his folks who were a bit worried about him being out there on his own. Sure. His dad asks if the homicidal cat is still about and if Jeremy's safe. So he's talked about the cat already. He tells his dad not to worry about it, but he tells us that the cat has apparently killed all of the hens at the farm. But they haven't seen it in over a week, the cat.
Do you think his dad was disappointed that he had to bring up the cat on the call? You know, to ask him about the cat. Is he really scared of a cat? Just ask him about it. Why don't you care about his life? I'll ask him about it. Is that cat still bothering you?
He gets back to the farm and Deborah has made him a birthday cake. That night, he reads The Lost Traveler.
By Ruth Van Todd. It's kind of a surrealist journey story. We have entered a realm of madness.
Well, the realm of madness we certainly have entered because on July 30th, there's that cat attack that I've been waiting for.
The cat is dead, is how he starts off. But there is a story to this. Sar and Jeremy were out in the tool shed building some bookshelves. I guess that's what they're calling it nowadays. The sun was going down and Deborah was going to bed early because she wasn't feeling well. Sar thinks it might be something in the well water. While they're working, they hear screaming. So they run to the house and up the stairs. They go to the room. Deborah says, wait, don't come in. I'll unlock the door soon. When she does open the door, she's in her bathrobe with a towel around her neck. Blood is seeping through. On the floor, half covered with bedclothes, is the gored body of Boada. Next to the body was an old black umbrella, the cat-killing weapon.
Death by umbrella.
She said that she was in bed, and it jumped on her and attacked her throat. Deborah threw it off, grabbed the umbrella, and the cat jumped at her and impaled itself on the umbrella. Which sounds a bit fishy to me.
Yeah, he's going to have to take that one to the vet, too. So remember how I was asking you about cats impaling themselves?
When looking at the cat corpse, Jeremy notes that the wound seems to have flaps of skins going out, not in, as you would think a stab wound would be like, and just happens to be the exact same spot where the old wound was. So really, really fishy. But of course, Jeremy doesn't seem to put as much concern into it as I would. They take care of her as best they could, but she seems fine. The wound seems superficial and seems to be healing already.
And her voice is all messed up, you know. She can't speak very loudly.
And she looks at Sar with the purest gratitude, not moving, not saying anything, not even blinking.
Not even blinking.
Dun, dun, dun.
So Jeremy is relieved that the cat is dead, and that is how he ends that journal entry. Now, July 31st, the doctor came in to check on Deborah. They put the cat's body in the freezer to keep it just in case, because they want to check it for rabies, because obviously that could be a problem. The doctor gave Deborah a clean bill of health and said that the wounds are almost completely healed already, which again seems strange, even though she seems a bit wobbly. And if you remember, the cat was also quite wobbly when it showed up.
This thing has moved on to Deborah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're seeing her go through all the things that the cat has already set up.
We also have the setup where the doctor says, you should have put the cat in the freezer earlier because it's already been decomposed. And it's like, oh, the cat was, when Guada was previously killed by the Shrugug, Guada's been rotting like a zombie. Mm-hmm. Just the magic has been keeping it from showing up.
Right.
And now that he's dead, it's instantly happening. And the other thing is, and this may just be me hallucinating, I may be turning into Jeremy here, but when he asks the doctor for exercises to do, and the doctor says, chopping wood and running down deer, what I got from that is the doctor is saying, read James Fenimore Cooper, not all this gothic stuff.
Interesting.
Don't read horror. Horror's terrible. It'll kill you. Read westerns. Go out and be a man.
I don't think you're hallucinating. I do think that
I think that might just be me.
Wow. They do a little funeral for the cat, but do it far away from the other cats because they, mm-hmm. you know, this is a hated cat. They put it in the unhallowed ground of cat cemeteries, I guess.
Right.
That night he reads from The King in Yellow.
And
yay! Yeah, one that we love and have covered on the show. And he talks about the idea in the story about the play The King in Yellow. One look at the real book, so Chambers would claim, and I might not live to see the morrow, at least through the eyes of a sane man. That single gimmick, masterful, I admit, seems to be his sole inspiration. So, a little bit of a dig.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I think that happens to most folks when they pick that book up and they realize that most of the stories are like romances about models.
Right.
You know, and not really right. the kind of hardcore horror they were expecting.
Exactly. And Repair of Reputations, that's got a cat attack in it.
Yeah, it does. It does. I'd also like to point out that even at the funeral for Buada, they say Deborah just mouths the words.
Mm.
Right? So we have a little of that Mackin spiritual evil is still there. That even though you would suspect that there's no prayer on earth that can stop this thing, she doesn't want to take the chance and say a sacred word and be exorcised.
Oh,
wow.
And then obviously, the other thing that The King in Yellow has in it, in the story of the Yellow Sign, mm-hmm. is about a creature that comes back from the dead. So we have a little of that as well.
Right.
And the difference between the pretend book, which is the Chambers stories, The King in Yellow, mm-hmm. that have no effect, and the real King in Yellow that will drive you crazy. Again, he's paralleling books that you read and books that you live. That's what he's been doing over and over and over again. And to get all of that into one line of one paragraph is why Klein is the man and we are the podcasters talking
about.
Absolutely correct.
That night, Sar made dinner and he's a bad cook. The freezer still smells of decay. We get into August 1st. Jeremy is writing in the morning. He was awakened at 2 a.m. by sounds in the woods. Wailing deeper than before, followed by a low guttural monologue. Mm. No words, at least that I could distinguish, if toads could talk. He's reading some M.R. James. When he opened up the book, a silverfish slithered out of it, which freaking hate silverfishes.
A silverfish in your book is the greatest note of terror that you can have for me.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
It's also something that would have creeped M.R. James out because he hated insects and spiders and bugs.
All right.
Interesting.
I think that the little shout out to James here is he's saying, this is not just a Mackin story. We're also doing M.R. James. It's everything that you love and is good and it's in here. And I think that the spiders are sort of his tribute to the ash tree and the M.R. James stories where everything is sort of spider-like.
Hmm.
And there's even a bit, I forget in which one of them is, where he reaches down and pats what he thinks is a cat, but it's actually a giant spider. It's all right there.
He talks about playing this game with himself, the what if game. And I've done this before and probably I do it more than I should, but it's kind of like,
what if this glorified chicken coop is sinking into quicksand? Wouldn't be surprised at all. What if the Poroths are tired of me? What if I woke up inside my own coffin? What if I never see New York again? What if some horror stories aren't really fiction? If Machen sometimes told the truth? If there are white people, malevolent little faces peering out of the moonlight, whispers in the grass, poisonous things in the woods, perfect hate and evil in the world.
He's really priming the pump here, getting us ready for the big bang.
Mm-hmm.
Entry August 9th, Jeremy and the Porths have a crappy meal that Sar cooked. They talk about politics and the world, and then Jeremy ends up doing the dishes. So there you go, finally happened.
Yeah.
They watch some TV, the news, and Jeremy makes note of Deborah's behavior as of late. He says she seems to have an insatiable curiosity about world events, yet she claims the isolation here appeals to her.
So is this the alien force gathering data on the world?
Yeah.
We're starting to see the expansion. It's so creepy.
Again, people watch TV, people watch the news. That's nothing supernatural, but again, with this context, it is creepy, and it is creeping me out, because it feels like that there are bigger implications, that it's not just this farmhouse that's in danger. It could be the world.
She's got her notebook out. George Clooney married. Okay.
Sar is doing some chanting prayers to himself, and this is making Jeremy feel a little uncomfortable, so he goes back to his cabin. He goes to bed. Another entry a few minutes later, his room is full of crickets, and...
Ugh.
Dude, the sound of crickets in your house sucks. Being from Illinois, I'm sure all of you gentlemen have experienced crickets in your house and how freaking loud and annoying they are. They're great when they're out in the woods outside of your house, but when they're in the house, they are, what he says, a cross between a radiator and a tea kettle. Very shrill. And that is correct. And then he wonders how they got in. August 14th, Jeremy notices the books were moved around and he's ticked that the Porths are coming into his room messing with his books. And then again, what's going on here? Why would this alien entity, if it has possessed Deborah, want to go through his books? Is it just gathering information? Is it interested in weird fiction? Or is it just messing with him?
I think it's a combination of gathering information and messing with him.
Yeah.
I think that the weird entity, we know that it's trying to get all the information it can from the TV. Either it could be one of those Jack Finney type, the aliens aren't like us and they don't know that Saki was a pseudonym, or it could be that the alien, that they're messing with Jeremy, like the slash across his window.
Mm-hmm.
Since it could be either one, maybe it's both, because it's Klein, which would be kind of hilarious that you are a gothic monster and to get information about the world, you read a lot of Lovecraft.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, this is the only time Lovecraft is checked here, right? Because when he arranged his stuff, it says he sat down to reread Lovecraft's essay on supernatural horror and literature. It upset me how little I've actually read, how far I still have to go. That I can certainly empathize with.
Sure. Yep.
It leaves him feeling depressed and tired. I just will never be as good as HPL.
The mood in the house has changed. Sar seems angry all the time, and Jeremy says this, which is weird in and of itself. He says, Sar used to be a sucker for her little girl pleadings. I remember how he used to carry her upstairs, sometimes pathetically tender, the moment she'd say, oh, honey, I'm so tired. Now he just becomes angry. Often he goes off morose alone to pray, and the only time he laughs is when he watches television. Now, who the hell carries their wife upstairs?
A young married couple.
Yeah.
Look, dude, my wife is petite, but I wouldn't do that, not because I couldn't do that, but because it just wouldn't dawn on me.
Keep telling yourself that.
Yep, I think we're beginning to get to the meat of this story.
Thou dost protest too much.
But what I'm saying is, that's a weird thing to do, to lift up another adult and like carry them around like a child. Seems very strange to me.
Well, nice if you can get it, though. I mean,
I think it's cute. I think it indicates the love that the Porths had before this horrible presence, by which I mean Jeremy, came into their life.
Uh-huh.
The fact that they can't do it anymore is indicating a rift in the lute. And I think that your marital stresses should not be read into this book, Chris.
I agree. It's super commonplace to carry each other around. I don't know what you're talking about. Last time I saw Ken, he was carrying me around like an Oscar. It was great.
Just like a man carries a man.
To be fair, my wife does carry me up the stairs every once in a while, but that's different because I'm the husband.
I do want to put a pin in the fact, you mentioned previously that Sar cooked and the food was bad. I think Deborah's cooking and the food is bad. And I think the food is bad because she's changed and we're letting us know that Deborah's bad.
Okay, yeah.
So
okay.
That's why the lamb is underdone. Yeah. That's why the vegetable omelet is tasteless.
Ah,
okay. I think that they're going back.
Like, we are having Windex and shrimp for dinner tonight.
Exactly.
That night, he reads some of John Christopher's The Possessors.
And that I know nothing about.
It's a bunch of people. They're snowed into a ski lodge, and there's an alien parasite there. It's the frickin' who goes there thing.
Ah, yes.
Over again. It's great because it's John Christopher. I mean, it's early John Christopher, but it's still good. I mean, this is the frickin' hanging a lantern on it. It's called The Possessors. It's about an alien parasite that possesses you. Guess what's going on?
Yep. Right.
They can't all be subtle in jokes about Mackin's diary and M.R. James's phobias.
Yes.
Sometimes a book about an alien parasite is just a book about an alien parasite.
As true today as it's ever been.
That's right.
August 19th, Jeremy goes for a walk down to the stream and he sees Deborah kneeling by the water. She is talking to herself, or so he believes. He interrupts her and she seems to be maybe embarrassed, not sure. Later on, he sees her at the house from a distance and he says it feels surreal. It's just like Deborah was stroking a cat, then seemed to grow angry when it struggled in her arms. I could hear the screen door slam as she went into the kitchen, but the sound reached me so long after the visual that the whole scene struck me as somehow fake.
That's a great weird touch.
He goes on to say that the sky seemed a strange green color. Couldn't focus on it or on the trees in the background. It just has this very unreal feeling. Or maybe he's describing someone who's suffering from the effects of long-term poisoning.
Exactly, because remember, Wada, or the alien, has taken the poison, carried it away somewhere, and we read way up at the very beginning of the story about polluted well water. And what hit it for me, what made me, when I was reading this, is he was saying, the sun on my head felt almost painful as if my brain were growing too large for my skull. Well, you know, he's not getting smarter over the course of the story. Yeah. So that seemed to me to be very much a symptom of actual poisoning. To go along with gothic fiction, alien monsters, unreliable narrating, we also have now genuine poison that he is now completely unable to know what's going on because he is being basically softened up for the kill by Deborah.
Now, he falls asleep on the grass, which, again, seems like something somebody might do if they're really not very well.
Yeah.
He's woken up by Sar for dinner. Sar whispers to him that he saw Deborah standing over him while he was sleeping. Now, you know, paralleling the cat earlier. Mm-hmm. Sar says that her eyes were wide, like Buada's. And Jeremy asks him what he means, and he says, because, he recited in a whisper, gripping my arm, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? That's a Bible quote from Jeremiah 17:9. Dinner was quiet and awkward. Deborah serves the guys their favorite dessert, chocolate mousse, but she doesn't give herself any because she says she's watching her weight. Then Sar flips out and says, then we'll not eat any. And he grabs both of their dishes and throws them against the wall. Deborah is still. She doesn't move and she seems unafraid. Jeremy gets up to get out of this crazy scene. And then Sar apologizes. He says, sorry, Jeremy, I know you hate scenes. We'll pray for each other, all right? Mm-hmm. Now, the strange bit here, Jeremy asks Deborah if she's okay. And he says he'll stay if she needs him for anything. And she says, things will work out.
And then he hears Sar laughing as he shuts the door.
Very weird. What does she mean by that? I mean, things will work out could be comforting or really horrific.
Well, I wonder about, you know, what kind of horror story is Sar going through right now? I wish I could get his perspective because it's got to be awful.
Oh.
It's his wife. He knows it's his wife, but he also knows it's not his wife.
Mm-hmm.
When Jeremy gets back to his cabin, he sees himself in his mirror and he's a mess. He hasn't bathed in a week. He hasn't shaved for 2 weeks. And his eyes have a yellow look like an old man's, he says. He starts packing up his stuff because, you know what? He's had enough. Yeah. He's done here. So August 20th, he gets up early, finishes packing, kills a big spider. He plans to go into town and call for the car rental. He's leaving early, but he's already paid the Porths for the month that he's going to be staying there, so he feels they shouldn't be offended.
Right.
He wants to have a shave and a shower before he goes into town because, like we said earlier, he's a mess. But the Porths aren't up yet, so he's waiting for them to get up. And he waits an hour, and he waits another hour, and then finally he goes in. And it says here, that's where the journal ends.
Yeah.
We get back to Jeremy's affidavit.
Now we're back to the beginning of the story.
It's almost a week since that day, and a lot has happened. He's locked himself up in this hotel room. He's even bought an extra lock and installed it in the door in his hotel because he feels so insecure and he needs that physical security. And he goes back into a story now of what happened, that event at Porth Farm. Now, when he was approaching the house, he notices that the blinds are all down. When he opens the door, this stench of decay is overpowering to him. He says something seems to have died in the room, but not recently, like something's been dead there for a long time. And then these four small shapes scramble out on the floor right past him. It's the cats.
Right.
And then Sar gets up off the floor and into the view, but he's sort of in shadow, so he can't get a really good look at him. He can only see his pale face. He says, oh, I'm sorry, Jeremy, I thought you were asleep, which is kind of a weird thing to say,
yeah,
you know, in the circumstance. Sard doesn't want Jeremy to turn on the lights, but he pulls up the blind on the door. He sees something gruesome.
I opened it wider and let in more sunlight. It fell on the dark thing at his feet, over which he had been crouching. Deborah, the flesh at her throat torn and wrinkled like the skin of an old apple. Her clothing lay in a heap beside her. She appeared long dead. The eyes were shriveled, sunken into sockets black as a skull's. I think I may have staggered at that moment because he came toward me. His steady, unblinking gaze looked so sincere. But why was he smiling?
And like the cat, yeah, seems like she'd been dead for quite a while.
And she's been rotting, yeah. And then again, this supernatural force that's possessed her has kept her seemingly alive.
Mm-hmm.
Sar says he had to do it. She tried to kill him, so he had to kill her. The thing that possessed the cat had possessed her. Jeremy points out that her throat is all tore up, but Sar says he didn't do that. It was the cat.
Mm.
And Deborah tried to stab him with a bread knife, and Sar starts looking around for the knife, and then Jeremy notices a metal glint in the light and realizes that the knife is stuck in his back.
Yeah.
Like way in there. Jeremy gasps, and it makes Sar kind of like think for a second, and he remembers, and then he starts kind of trying to reach his back.
Such an alien thing. It's so creepy.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't get to it.
Yeah.
Somebody else stabbed him because he couldn't have done it to himself. Mm-hmm. So he was definitely attacked and he can't reach it. And it says, afterwards, he turned toward me and shrugged in embarrassment. A child caught in a foolish error. Oh yeah, he said, grinning at his own weakness. I forgot it was there. So good. Yeah, so creepy.
This confrontation is so great and so terrifying because it combines, again, I guess we were talking about how the sort of post-block human madness enters the equation, real, genuine psychological derangement, not Lovecraftian sort of shock and horror.
Right.
This is a real affect. You believe that this is happening when you're reading it, that he's like, oh yeah, I forgot it was there. And that's so literally out of connection with what should be going on that it just throws you in there. But it comes from the humans are behaving weirdly, not that nature is behaving weirdly. And that's a great bit of this. And I think it's another part of why it's a 1972 story, not a 1932 story.
Absolutely. He gets closer to Jeremy and he says, it's easy for us to forget things. And then he gets closer and he says something else, which makes Jeremy run like hell.
Yeah.
Lovecraft, where it's like, oh, we're not going to hear what the climactic phrase is.
Well, except we do at that end of the end of the thing. Yeah.
A cool chase scene.
Yeah. He runs, yes. And it's this like slasher scene, right? Because he runs off and down the wooded road and he thinks he's gotten away from Sar. And then boom, there's Sar. He runs into him again as he rounds a bend and he's laughing at him. Finally, we find out that what Sar said was, sometimes we forget to blink.
Now, it's not actually italicized, but it
might as well be.
It might as well be, and yeah. It's pretty horrifying.
And also, since he says we, that kind of goes to our thought that maybe there's more of them out there in the woods.
Yeah.
And if they're not in the woods, they're somewhere else in the world.
They're in the outer realm or whatever that opened the door.
But you're right, I didn't even think about that. The we is truly terrifying.
So the local paper covered the story, mostly what they say. It was a lunatic wife slaying from loneliness, religious mania, and tainted well water, which they test and they find out was insecticide.
There you go.
I guess the missing bug spray. The paper also implies that Sar was jealous of Jeremy and his wife, and that's why he killed her.
Hmm.
The police found her body partially buried. A bread knife had been plunged into the door of the guest house. His journal was hidden under his mattress and still there, but all of his other books were destroyed. Sar was never found alive or dead.
Oh, great.
He knows that the cops think of him as a suspect. Maybe he killed Sar and Deborah. They don't have any proof, but the cops want to close the case. You know how police are. They just,
yeah,
they got to put it on somebody. He's not arrested, but they ask him not to leave town.
He thinks the story is going to be that he killed Deborah in a fit of passion, immediately afterward disposed of Sar. He points out that their marriage had been an observably happy one until I arrived, a disturbing influence from the city. It does make a good story.
Yeah.
My motive, he says, was simple lust, unrequited to be sure, aggravated by boredom. The heat, the insects, and most of all the oppressive loneliness all constituted an environment alien to any I'd been accustomed to, and all worked to unhinge my reason. And hey, is that really what happened?
Is that the story?
And we have sort of a setup because Klein points out, and Jeremy points out, that two different papers have two different versions of the story. Huntington County Democrat just says it's those crazy religious folk and their poison well, and the Somerset Reporter is the one that says, lurid love triangle ends in gothic horror. So the fact that there are two conventional stories about this unconventional story. And then he says what may be the funniest line in all of horror literature. I have no cause for fear, however, because this affidavit will certainly establish my innocence.
That's all it takes.
After that, he wonders about this thing and what it is or was. And he says the thing was once a cat and once a woman and once what? A large white moth, a serpent, a shrew-like thing with wicked teeth.
Or all of them.
A police chief, a president, a boy with eyes of blood that sits beneath my window. Great. So it's a real invasion of the body snatchers, John Carpenter's The Thing sort of scenario going on here. And he thinks it all started when he made the signs in the trees and the crickets missed that beat and the clock stopped as well. Was that it? Is that what happened? He doesn't know. He says, I once read comparing a natural and supernatural and something about a tiny rent in the fabric of the universe, just large enough to let something in, something not of nature and hard to kill, something with its own obscure purpose.
He was reading The Myth of Pandora when he had that tiny rent in the fabric of the universe line. So he thinks that when he made those signs, he kind of opened Pandora's box, right? That's what it was.
Finally, he says the police may be right. Maybe it was him and what he did, meaning as in he did the signs and opened up something.
Right. It's not literally the way the police think it went down,
no.
But he is saying maybe it was me. He feels responsible. He let something in. And as he's sitting in the hotel room watching that kid, he thinks, well, I don't know if this can be stopped.
I've just checked. He hasn't moved from the steps of the courthouse. And even when I look out my window, the rose spectacles never waver. Who knows where the eyes beneath them point? Who knows if they remember to blink? Lord, this heat is sweltering. My shirt is sticking to my skin, and droplets of sweat are rolling down my face and dripping onto this page, making the ink run. My hand is tired from writing. I think it's time to end this affidavit. If, as I now believe possible, I inadvertently called down evil from the sky and began the events at Poroth Farm, my death will only be fitting. And after my death, many more. We are all, I'm afraid, in danger. Please, then, forgive this prophet of doom, old at 30, his last Jeremiad. The harvest is past. The summer is ended. And we are not saved.
And that is the end of the story.
And there we have the word Jeremiah, as you said in our first episode.
We have that little note of words changing and being unreliable when he literally says the drops of sweat are rolling down his face and making the ink run. So his narrative is not just unreliable on its face, it's literally a twisted narrative.
Even visually, yeah.
It doesn't even visually look correct because he's already gotten it wet and crummy with his sweat.
Now, Ken, what was your first interaction? I only read this for the first time this last month. What was your first interaction with the story? When did you come across it?
I came across it when I read The Ceremonies, which is the novel that Klein turned this into in 1984. And I read The Ceremonies because I was dredging up all the horror I could possibly read. It was first or second bloom of my Lovecraft love, and I was reading a bunch of horror. And I think this may have even said in the tradition of Arthur Machen on the back, or in the tradition of Lovecraft, something made me pick that up as opposed to all the other novels that had the identical cover in 1984. And I read it, and it just tore my soul open to read that story. But I don't know at what point I learned that The Ceremonies was an expanded version of the novelette Events at Poroth Farm. At the time that I read it, I was still sort of just cooked up from all the, you know, giant cosmic conspiracies in The Ceremonies, and I felt a little let down because it didn't have the vast scope of a 500-page novel, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And then I've reread it a couple of times since then, and every time I reread it, it's like, oh, this is a lot better than I remember it being. And then when you asked me to do this with you guys, I reread it again. It's like, no, this is actually, in its own way, as good as or even better than The Ceremonies, because it does so much of what that novel does, but in a 40-page package, not a 500-page package.
Sure.
You get sort of the full-on heroin shot right into your vein there from this story. I love it better every time I read it. If I reread it again, you know, who knows how much I'm going to love it.
Who can predict?
Not to, you know, butter you guys' parsnips, but it's so perfect for this podcast specifically because it's doing what your podcast is doing, is trying to sort of take these old stories and draw them out and connect them to a modern audience, a modern in 1972, but yeah, more modern certainly than the ones that they were being written for, and make them relevant and find that. And so this is, the story is sort of HP Podcraft in story form in a way, because yeah, it's so interconnected and so woven with all of these elements and all of these happenings. The horror of the horror is very Lovecraftian, Chambersian, metafictional thing, but it also is kind of what keeps you guys doing this.
I know, it's crazy. I mean, I think that that's why this story has been recommended to us so many times. That's why we broke the rule. I mean, I think this has been recommended more than anything else.
Yeah.
And it's because it's kind of uniquely suited to what we're doing here.
Maybe the 2017 version of this story is some guys going off to record a podcast or something.
Yeah.
Just has to get away from the city because the horns and the noises are too loud.
Exactly.
Ken, thank you for spending time with us covering the story. Your insight has been invaluable. Absolutely. And much appreciated.
Oh, no, thanks for having me on, guys.
Always love chatting with you. And I also want to once again thank our reader for these series of shows, Andrew Staten. He's done a great job. Thanks so much, Andrew.
He is awesome. Thank you, Andrew. And I want to remind folks about Ken Height's Kickstarter, which is just about finishing.
It winds up on August the 28th. So if you're listening to this much later, go buy it online. But
yeah,
the book is Tour to Lovecraft, The Destinations, the sequel to Tour to Lovecraft, The Tales. And hopefully it will also be expanding Tour to Lovecraft, The Tales. So you'll get even more stuff in that too.
So good.
Excellent. Go support it, folks.
And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Kenneth Height.
And you've been listening to the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast
on hppodcraft.com.
HPPodcraft.com.